Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. You're listening to Bristol's first podcast, believe it or not, from 2002, Dialect, on our Friday afternoon 2pm slot on BCFM 93.2. This week we have part two of the history of disabled movement in Britain. That is with Jason Yannakopoulos. Also, Maurice Kirk is back, the daredevil aviator. Plus our weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect's produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2 every Friday afternoon. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square, and phone numbers 0117 989 7733. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number's 01454 318 753. And we'll have a reminder of both those phone numbers for Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. So to start this week, Maurice Kirk is back. Hi, Maurice, and welcome to Dialect again.
Hi, good afternoon.
Now, the idea of bringing you in here, Maurice, is because last time I didn't really feel like we finished chatting properly. You talked so much about your illustrious career in aviation and various other things, and then we kind of left it at the litigant in person business. So maybe the best thing to do is pick up where we left off there, and just if you could just recap on this whole business of what is a litigant in person, and go through, I suppose, how you discovered that such a litigant in person, such a thing existed.
I come from Taunton, and I remember being taken to Crown Court in Bournemouth for being drunk in charge of an aeroplane. Now, this must have been back in 1980, and I used a barrister. And he said, well, if you're found guilty, it could be a £50 or £100 fine. And I thought, fair enough, the fact that I was not drunk, not the pilot, and I was sitting in the passenger seat, I thought I had a good chance of being okay. I was found guilty and given a 6-month prison sentence. I lost my chance to finish my airline pilot's exams. I already had a commercial license, and I was just sitting my instructor's exams. I was very bitter because I was the only one in the courtroom who understood the court case. The story of it, which is very long and we won't go into now. But I read the books. I started picking up law books and started to learn the law. And of course, in these last 20, 30, 40 years, the situation has got quite dire within our courts. More and more people like me defend ourselves. We're called LIPs, litigants in person. We do it for different reasons. A, because we are not satisfied with the legal services available. If you're self-employed like I was, I have to pay for something which I'm not satisfied with. And also on technical matters like being a pilot, I was streaks ahead of the people in the courtroom, knowing I was innocent and very frustrated to be found guilty. That was the incentive to learn about this.
Now, I know you don't want to go too much into that case,
no.
But I think it helps for people to understand. You know, you're giving us an example there of something,
yes,
where you knew a lot more about what had actually happened.
Exactly.
Now, surely every defendant in a court case will say that.
Yes. Now, we have the procedure of having a solicitor and a barrister, and it might surprise you that I still maintain that is essential. A lot of people, my friends, litigants in person, and Mackenzie friends, those are people who help stand beside a defendant or someone in a civil action and help them quietly with their case, but not allowed to have right of audience. Litigants in person is very, very important at the moment because there has just these last few weeks been a Supreme Court ruling on the matter of private prosecutions. Now, private prosecutions are a spin-off from litigants in person. I have been known to arrest a number of people in the past for breaking the law and using the rights of a private person to arrest someone and take it on if the Crown Prosecution Service do not prosecute that man for breaking the law. A clear case, clear-cut case. I have carried on and done just that. But each time it has been blocked. But last week, the week before, this 3-2 judgment in the Supreme Court has opened the doors for people like us to be able to continue to pursue private prosecutions. And this is all to do with white-collar crime. You must have heard that expression.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes. I mean, this is to do with sort of desk crime and paperwork crime, this kind of thing.
But it's more than that. It is to do with those that are immune to prosecution. And there is a large section of our community now that are immune to prosecution. I have been the witness myself of so much of this. I remember last time I touched on being in prison, on remand, and how the system was not is in meltdown. I'm also very knowledgeable in the way that they have divided the people into those that are immune to prosecution and those that are easy meat.
Well, just a minute, because, I mean, people like Andy Coulson, who was at the very top of British society as the press secretary to the Prime Minister, he thought he was immune to prosecution. Sometimes people who think they're immune to prosecution aren't, are they?
Yes, but I was waiting for you today to use that as an example, and I led you into it because, of course, they occasionally do a high flyer to try and quell the arguments that we have, and we are gathering due to internet and websites. There are many, many people in high places and positions of power who are getting away with white-collar crime. And with the country in a bad way, there is a lot of fraud going on between the banks, the lawyers, and the poor people who've invested their money into a property. And those groups of people are all being protected, except the poor person that has just lost his house and is in court for bankruptcy or whatever. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of those, but every now and again it's politically expedient to produce somebody to make us all think that all is sweet and daisy in our courts. They are not.
Now, it's maybe a good time to mention Sabine's website, which is victims-unite.net, which is one of the places where people like you and others have been able to network and actually share knowledge that they've gained through this whole, basically being your own solicitor.
Yes. Sabine took an interest in me and came over to France and had a bit of a shock. because I broke her into the whole subject of the legal system and what is going wrong in our courts. I call her the Queen Bee. She is a wonderful organiser, and she is now gathering together and sifting out the people who talk too much, like me and lots of others, and is sorting out and making contact with those that might be able to do something about it. And that is, of course, our group in London called Members of Parliament. Now, a lot of my friends will laugh at that, and I've always maintained that what have we got members of Parliament for but to control our community and to do our wishes democratically. And Sabine McNeill is an excellent lady for the job.
Okay, so can we just go back, though, to your court case? I feel we haven't quite tied up the loose ends there.
Which
with
one?
Original one with you, where you're a passenger in an aircraft, you're not drunk, but you're then accused. I mean, this is we're giving you your witness statement now. How on earth does a court turn that into you being in charge of an aircraft and drunk, if what you're saying is true?
I was offered £100,000 to do one flight in an aircraft back in the 70s by drug dealers. And I thought about it, not that I was going to do it, but I thought about whether I should report it. I reported it to the Taunton police, and it created, and because I was having a running battle with using my aircraft to go around the farms, you remember I mentioned that last time, I was accused of speeding, and I lost my driving license, so I used my aircraft, so I was known as the flying vet. I think I was persecuted by the police because I was then put on a shortlist of possible pilots who flew drug dealers. Now, I was bringing back one of my old aeroplanes back from France because I was importing a lot of old aeroplanes from France in the 70s because the French were chopping them up and setting fire to them and just throwing them away. And I was on one of these trips, and I always took a young chap with me who paid me for the flight to learn experience. And we were coming in a snowstorm at night in a single-engine aeroplane in November just to Bournemouth, and they gave us the wrong information on radar, and I took the radio equipment and spoke. And I had had a farewell drink with the air traffic family in France, in Morlaix, and I wasn't the pilot. And when we landed, there were deer and hare on the runway, so I picked up the microphone and said, could somebody lend me a shotgun? I want a bag of hare, or something like that, i.e. it's their responsibility to clear the runway. One thing led to another, and we parked, and I was accused of piloting the aircraft on the ground too close to a parked aircraft. It had nothing to do with this. I finished up, but it was all to do with the politics of somebody asking them to stop me from flying.
But I mean, it's a bit unwise, isn't it, to have a drink just before you get into an aircraft and fly like that? Isn't that something that you as a pilot should know not to do?
I know lots of people who get into aircraft who have a drink, and they are often served drinks while they're in the aircraft. I was not the pilot. I took over when I realised that the pilot with me, who was fully qualified, did not understand that the radar from Southampton that covers the airspace over Bournemouth, it did in those days, had given him wrong information. The weather was very bad. It was snowing. We're in a single-engine aircraft. We didn't have a dinghy. I wanted the straightest route to Bournemouth Airport, and I wasn't going to be diverted due to an error by a radar navigator. And my chap with a wig on, what do you call them, barrister, didn't understand that, of course, the rules of the air are put aside under emergency conditions. It was technically an emergency condition. I only made a comment, say, you have given us wrong information, but in court they said, no, you were in control of the aircraft because you used the radio. Well, of course, if I'd been doing that case myself, I would have explained all that, but that was never even mentioned to the jury.
Okay, Maurice, we're going to come back and have a chat with you in a minute. First, some music from Louis Armstrong.
Jonah was a man, got a word from the Lord, go and preach the gospel to a sinful land. But he got on a ship and he tried to get away, and he ran into a storm in the middle of the sea. Now the Lord, he made the wave just to roll so high, the ship began to sink and they all began to cry. So they pulled old Jonah out of the hole, and they chunked him in the water just to lighten up the load. Now the Lord made a whale long and wide.
Lord, Lord, what manner of fish?
And he swallowed up Jonah, hair and hide.
Lord, Lord, what manner of fish? Lord, Lord.
Now Jonah started to pray in the belly of the whale.
Lord, Lord, what manner of fish?
He repented of his sins like a man in jail.
Lord, Lord, what manner of fish? Lord, Lord.
Now Jonah must have been a bad man. He must have been a sinner.
Lord, Lord, what manner of fish?
'Cause when the whale got him down, he didn't like his dinner.
Lord, Lord, what manner of fish?
Well, he swam around the ocean, sick as he could be. Lord, Lord, wasn't that a fish? And after 3 days, whoops, he had to set him free.
Lord, Lord,
wasn't that a fish? So the whale spit Jonah out on the dry land.
Lord, Lord, wasn't that a fish?
And he went on to preaching like a righteous man.
Lord, Lord, what manner of fish?
Then the people quit their sins when they heard him into town.
Lord, Lord, what manner of fish?
So when you hear the call, don't you turn the gospel down. Lord, Lord, what manner of fish?
Louis Armstrong there. And we're with Maurice Kirk, resuming our aviation and legal chat. Now, while we were listening to that, you were saying, Maurice, that you've got a couple of aviation stories. I think that's one of the things I remember best from the last one. Last time we spoke to you is this kind of daredevil approach that you seem to take to flying, particularly when you're on your own. You know, I think you've got a quite a good attitude of safety when there are other people. But if you're flying on your own, you seem to be a bit of an adrenaline junkie of some sort. But anyway, do tell us a bit more about your aviation experiences.
Well, some of my stories take 2 hours. I mean, there's the purported story of me landing on President Bush's ranch. I landed and finished up in a...
First of all, what were you doing in the US?
Well, I had just sunk my lovely D-Day Cub aircraft in the Caribbean, about 100 miles south of the Caicos Islands. I was on the way down to the Falkland Islands, which has been my dream. And she sank, the engine, the old donkey stopped, and I sank, and I was in the water for about 3 hours. It was getting dark, and I was getting very, very cold. And I suddenly remembered I had an EPIRB around my neck, which is one of these satellite beacon systems. And as it was getting dark, I thought, well, who's having breakfast? Is it going to be me or the sharks? And I didn't think I was going to live till breakfast. I was so cold. And Julie, a pilot from the Coast Guard, came out in a great big Jayhawk helicopter and dropped a diver. And they came, and I was shaking. It swam to me, and I was shaking like a leaf. And I said, why are you so damned late? I've been here for 3 hours. Anyway, months later, I'd bought another old Cub in Florida, the same sort of Cub, but a pre-war Cub. And I decided to thank President Bush, so I went to take a letter, but it all went pear-shaped. Thank Mr. Bush for saving my life. A cat has 9 lives. The number Maurice Kirk has is debatable, because I've only told you one or two stories. Anyway, I finished up, to cut a very long story short, in Waco prison, and then in chains around in the psychiatric hospital of a prison of Austin, Texas.
And I suppose that's because it was not necessarily they weren't expecting someone to fly, and they probably thought you were a terrorist or something.
Yes, I landed 25 yards outside the prohibited zone in a farmer's field. And I broke no aviation law, which was confirmed by the Federal Aviation Authority when they rang me that same day.
Yeah, but hang on a minute. You can't just land in a field. I mean, you know, okay, if it's an emergency landing, no one's going to worry too much, but you can't just land in a field, Maurice.
I think the story went that there was lightning and thunder, and I was frightened, and I landed. I forget how it went now, but it was in the paper, I think. But The stories I was telling you earlier about taking aircraft out of France, we back in the 70s, there were only about 6 of us in the whole country making a bit of a game of it, and most people took them out by lorry, and I was flying them across. And I remember one occasion I bought an aeroplane in Cherbourg for £400. And when I was telling you earlier, we'd moving them out to Morlaix, which is further west, because of my problems with the administration of Cherbourg. They wouldn't let me fly it out. Apparently it hadn't flown for 7 years, and it had birds' nests in it, and it was really getting quite old. A little wooden aeroplane, Jodel, a bit like a Stuka, but very small, two-seater. So I crept through the grass, long grass, on a Sunday lunchtime, when they're all having their lunch. You know what it's like in France. Everything stops in France. Not allowed to phone anybody, you're not allowed to knock on a door, nothing. It's eating, it's sacred period. I know, I lived there. And I got to the aeroplane, and I quickly put in some jerry cans of fuel, pulled the propeller, and away she went. And I jumped in, and they came pouring out of the control tower from the restaurant, and they jumped on an old Dennis fire engine. Now, if those who don't know what a Dennis fire engine is, it's got a great big ladder on the top with a great big wheels at the back, made in Coventry. And there was this great big brass radiator with Dennis written on it. And I knew this English fire engine for years, and they chased me down the runway. and they were hanging on, just like out of Toy Town. And they were ringing the bell.
It sounds like the Keystone Cops.
They were ringing the bell, and I gave them the French Connection wave, and I got airborne, and I thought, I've got away. Here is an aeroplane only bought for £400. I'll be in England in an hour and a half. 20 minutes later, she caught fire, and smoke came pouring through into the cockpit. Now, she had gullwing plastic with doors where you sort of open up like the old Mercedes car, vintage car. And so I had to carry on flying with my head out of the window.
Now, hang on, where were you, over land at this point?
I was now about 10 miles out to sea. And I said, I must get to the FIR boundary, which is the boundary belonging to France and the boundary belonging to England, because if I get picked up by a lifeboat from France, I go to prison. If I get picked up by a Southampton lifeboat, I should be all right. Anyway, the radio didn't work, and the smoke eventually cleared. It must have been a bird's nest on the engine, on the exhaust system. Because I'd expected it 3 weeks before when I bought it, but when I came back I had to steal it. I had to steal my own aeroplane, basically, so I had to just simply crawl through the grass and get in it. Now, the radio didn't work for Exeter, so I landed at Taunton Racecourse and rang my wife from the phone box and said, look, tell Exeter I'm landing in 20 minutes. And I got airborne and I landed at Exeter Airport, and two customs officers came marching out, and they had an expression on their faces, and I thought, something they know that I don't know. Now, what is this? And I looked at them, and they looked towards the wheels of the aircraft, and there was cow manure on one of them. I said, sod it. They know I've landed in a field. Have you been anywhere, Mr. Kirk, since you left Cherbourg? And so I said, yes, I had to land at Taunton Racecourse. They confiscated it for 3 months, put it in a heated hangar. I sold it where it was for £1,600. And I thought that was a good day's work.
It's a very good deal, reasonably good deal. Morris, going back to the George Bush incident and over, yes, in the United States, did you actually get to meet any of the staff there on the ground?
Well, I was wearing my top hat as I went up the road, and I was trying to take photographs of the scissor bird, the one with the tail like a magpie. Instead of going up and down, it goes like a scissors. And I suddenly heard a squeal of tyres behind me, and I recognised the squeal as a police car. I'm sort of used to this. And so I froze, and I put my camera out, and I stretched my arms out sideways, and I shuffled round quietly and lay down on the concrete without even looking to see what the car was. And I said, Kirk, this time, shut up. Don't shoot. Don't talk, or they'll shoot you. And there were two young kids there. They must have been about 25, in immaculate kit, lovely cut suits and new boots. I could see their boots because they were right in front of my face. And as I looked up, they put the handcuffs on. They had a Beretta each, pistol in their hands, and their hands were shaking like mad. And shaking, I said, shut up, don't say a word, or you're dead. And the relief on their face when they put the handcuffs on was amazing. And it was all run from the Pentagon. They were getting the information from Pentagon. Right, take him back to the aircraft. There were 11 police cars. And then Cold Hand Luke, the Texan, the sheriff arrived, you know, with the glasses and the big Stetson hat. He said, right, we can make him walk the line. And walk the line? I said, what do you mean, walk the line? I said, oh, you mean walk the line? Oh, you aren't suggesting I've had a drink of alcohol, do you? I've just flown in under those pylons.
Under the pylons?
Yes,
Morris.
Well, there are electric pylons across the field. Well, it was a suitable field. And they then made me do heel to toe. And they said, you'll do 9. I said, I can't do that with all this. I've got all this metal in this ankle. I can't do that. I'll give it a go. Well, I did. And I did one for luck. And they said, you failed. I said, what do you mean? You did one too many. Right, take him to Waco prison. So the entourage, this great long cortege, I could almost call it, by now they had chains around my ankles and handcuffs. And they took me. Of course, word got about very quickly in Waco prison that a mad Englishman was in the prison of 1,000 prisoners. Everybody came out.
Sorry, Morris, I just correct you. Eccentric Englishman.
Sorry?
An eccentric Englishman.
Oh, right. And they said, you've got to breathe into this box. And I said, what if I don't? And they didn't know how to answer that. I said, OK. And out a piece of paper came, and it said, naught, 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 naught. And I said, what do four zeros mean? And they said, right, put him in the cell. And they came back, and they took me out of the cell. They said, right, we want a urine test. I said, a urine test? Oh, you mean you want a urine sample? I'm terribly sorry, gentlemen, but I've just been to the loo. What do you mean, the loo? I said, well, I've that thing in the corner. Oh, and there was, they slammed the door, and there was another 10 minutes go by, and two voluptuous nurses come in, white, in white, you know. One looked at Marilyn Monroe, sort of 5 year older, Marilyn Monroe, and they had with them tubes and bottles and a big squeegee bottle thing, rather what I used for constipated dogs. And they said, do you want this the easy way or the hard way? And I said, ladies, what sort of sample would you like? And they creased. They doubled up with laughter, and they were the first people in Texas that day I had seen, even with a smile on their face.
Well, you put a smile on a lot of our faces anyway, Maurice. Great story. Going back for a minute to what a lot of this is about, which is people who are networking on the Victims Unite website. Sabine McNeil, website is victims-unite.net. Victims Unite! Exclamation mark, it says, while helping each other when fighting fraud and white-collar crimes. And there's a helpline there, which is Maggie on 01702. 341999. The big story on there at the moment, in 20th of November, is we are looking at the biggest failure to protect children in the history of Britain. That is a quote from Scallywag magazine in the 1990s. Scallywag's an interesting magazine.
It.
Yeah, I do. It was Simon Regan. Is his little baby. He was a kind of retired journalist, forced into retirement by Rupert Murdoch, in fact, when Murdoch took over The Sun. He was he was a reporter on The Sun, and I think maybe for a little while whilst Murdoch was running it, and then he decided that he couldn't cope as a journalist with Murdoch as a proprietor, and so he went off and did his own thing. But Simon Regan also wrote, I know, one of the very first things I ever read about the Diana assassination, called Who Killed Diana, something like that.
Yes.
Which was a little pamphlet where he showed that he and some of his friends in London had actually been given a painting which was to be used at the announcement in London of the engagement of Dodi El-Fayed and Princess Diana. The painting was going to be unveiled actually at the engagement party, which was all booked and due and ready to happen when she was so sadly killed over in Paris. I mean, I don't know. The official story, of course, is that it was all a big accident, but anyone that bothers to really look into it, particularly through the books of John Morgan, an Australian, has put together a really good compilation of material from all the various police inquiries, which proves pretty conclusively that there was a political motive behind getting Diana out of the way, mainly to do with things like landmines and her being a big landmine campaigner, and also, of course, the fact that she was she would have been, if she had married Dodi, then William and Harry would both have had a Muslim stepfather, which was also considered potentially, anyway, to be a bad thing by the royal family and the sort of group that surrounds the royals. Anyway, Maurice, that's a little bit of a diversion, but the website is there. It's victims-unite.net, and I know some of your material, some of your stories are up there, and many others who have also taken a similar route. So let's get round to really finishing off by talking about this whole litigant in person business. You started by saying that you'd hired a barrister. Would you advise anyone that's in a court case to just simply do that, or do you think that you know there are several things you should ask yourself before hiring a solicitor or a barrister, and how do you make that decision, I suppose I'm saying, about how whether to represent yourself in court or whether to go through the system and hire a barrister, hire a solicitor?
Oh, it's very simple. In those days, I was very ignorant, but I had a cherished education, a very good education, and it was no doubt that I would instruct a solicitor, my family solicitor from Taunton in those days, and instruct a barrister. I still approve of that system. and to have solicitor and barrister is very important to keep the victim or the injured person at arm's length from the barrister, so that the barrister can simply do his technical work in his criminal case and civil case. But in my case today, in that example I gave you, I soon realised that I could do this myself. I mean, my 90% success rate in the criminal courts of Cardiff is an example. But today I was in court, a civil action, and I used a solicitor. And the staff in the building in Cardiff Justice Centre were amazed, and they came up and made all crack jokes, saying, "What on earth are you doing with a solicitor?" And I said, "I'm burnt out. My brain is gone. I can't do it anymore. I am burnt out. Civil case is no good. Criminal, oh, that's different. I get my teeth into those. I'm waiting for the next criminal case against me, you know."
You're rubbing your hands for the...
I am rubbing my hands.
This is the radio, you're rubbing
your hands. Well, because it's so corrupt and dishonest. You can no longer trust anybody in a Welsh courtroom. I have just had experiences in Cardiff, in Bristol Court. I've just won a case here in Crown Court in Bristol. The service, the quality of the people at the door, the clerk of the court, the two judges, I won't name them, was impeccable. I was impressed. I went away 10 years younger, thinking I've got justice. I won the case. It was transferred from Cardiff. But please don't ask me to compliment anybody in the legal system in Cardiff. It stinks.
The Welsh court's not as good as the court we've got here in Bristol.
They are looking for, please understand this, they are now openly admitting that they are looking for their own judicial system, just like Scotland is trying to cut itself off and go bankrupt. Wales are doing the same, and they've kept very quiet. The local people in Wales do not know what's going on, and it's all based on greed. The money that is being poured into the legal system and being stolen by the lawyers, it's a cartel. There's a cartel in our law courts now. Well, I was in the prison, in your Bristol prison, doing 16 cases. No, sorry, in the Cardiff prison before I got transferred. I was on remand, remember I told you, and then got released, and they've dropped all charges. But in Bristol, in Cardiff prison last month, or the month before, I was acting for 16 prisoners, and I had all their cases, and I was working on them in my prison to stop me going daft. And each solicitor was getting £5,000 cheque for the most minor of incidents, and they only had to go to court once or twice, and they got £5,000. And some of them were milking the system to tell the client to do different things to what was what you would call common sense.
Well, one of the other aspects of this is just a tiny item on Points West a couple of months ago, was that even our court system here in Bristol, the magistrates' courts are having actual trouble financing all of the cases that are coming before them, and they're having to delay cases because there isn't the money to pay the staff. I mean, this is a pretty appalling state of affairs, particularly when we've got, I think it's £31 trillion squirreled away in tax havens, which is away from the tax man. We've heard this news about Starbucks not paying any tax, even though they're making a fortune in Britain. Actually, they're not paying tax. And then, you know, we've got a bit of a difficult situation. So ultimately, Morris, what would you say is your advice? We're talking here about people who may have to end up in court. What's your advice for people that do end up in court, even if it's just simply fighting an eviction order? Say, for example, you can't pay your mortgage, someone's trying to reclaim your home, that kind of thing.
It's very obvious. Those that are not up to it must take legal advice. But the legal advice has got to come from somebody who doesn't have an axe to grind. They've got to be independent. And that's very difficult in this day and age, to find a lawyer on the high street who hasn't got some ulterior motive. And that is what's wrong. That's something going wrong there. Only a few people can really be litigants in person. I've learnt by, what is it we say about people who are good at snooker? When I was in the prison, I said, "You're only good at snooker." A sign of ill-spent youth. I am good at being a litigant in person because I have been persecuted by the South Wales Police. And may I take this opportunity to say that my experiences with the professions, especially the medical professions, there's something seriously going wrong there. That's another big subject I would love to tell you about one day.
Okay, well, that's a bit of a scary prospect. But anyway, just to remind listeners, the website is Victims Unite. That is victims-unite.net. And the helpline is Maggie on 01702 341 999. Maurice
and
Kirk.
And my website.
Go on.
KirkFlyingVet.com.
Maurice Kirk, thanks very much for being with us again. I will welcome you back in a few weeks' time, I hope.
Thank you very much.
I'm gonna lay down my heavy load
down by the riverside. Oh. Down by the riverside.
Yeah.
Down by the riverside.
I'm gonna lay down my heavy load
down by the riverside.
I'm gonna study
one more.
I ain't gonna study one more. Ain't gonna study one more.
I
ain't gonna study
why no more.
I ain't gonna study for no more.
Ain't gonna study
for
no
more. I ain't gonna study.
From 1958, Louis Armstrong, Down by the Riverside. Now I'm joined by Jason Yiannakopoulos to really pick up on where we left off last week, Jason, with the history of the disabled movement in Britain. Hi.
Hello, once again.
Now, where were we? It was, I think, Second World War, just after the Second World War.
Yeah.
Let's recycle back to around about that time, you know, 1940s and 50s.
Well, we'll start with the 1948, when the National Health Service Act was passed by Parliament, where the Labour government at the time constructed a welfare state with the introduction of the National Health Service. This marked the end of the previous existing welfare state of the deserving poor charitable approach to disabled people, even though the philosophy actually continued.
Well, the health service, we can't not... You just mentioned the health service like just like that, because it's one of the most fantastic things that's ever been created, in my view.
Well, no doubt.
You know, because it was one of those things that, you know, during the Second World War, people were being dragged out of buildings. There is this kind of capitalist, privatised view that, well, when someone's ill, you've got to check their health insurance, you've got to make sure the paperwork's fine, and then they can get some treatment, maybe, if they can afford it. If they can't, then, you know, sorry, guys, but, you know, that's life, you know. Now, I think in the Blitz, and, you know, when people are being dragged out of buildings, there was a recognition there was something wrong about the idea of having to check paperwork before we decide if society can treat somebody. Basically, if society can't treat somebody, then there's something wrong with the society. And I, you know, maybe I'm exaggerating, but I think humanity actually took a step forward with the creation of the National Health Service.
I totally agree with that. The only problem is that now it appears to be taking two steps back with,
well, that's
privatisation.
Right. I mean, there was one of the most frightening films I've ever seen, actually, was put together by Spinwatch, which is looks at lobbying. I don't know if it still is, it certainly was based at Strathclyde University in Glasgow for quite a while. and it's a woman called Tamsin Cave. When they first, the coalition government first turned up on the scene and pulled this thing out of the hat called, oh yeah, we're going to allow these private health companies to cherry pick large sectors National Health Service to just as happened with the post office, pretty much, you know, where companies came in and all of the profitable parts of the business were then done by private businesses and the state controlled business was then left to do all the rest. That's now what's been happening in the health service. Now, not to say that the coalition government started all this, of course they didn't. It was New Labour, really, that got the ball rolling. But anyway, you know, certainly it's a frightening prospect. And
it's ridiculously frightening prospect for disabilities.
And, yeah, I mean, you know, it's the other thing is if you go to hospitals around this city, around Britain, anywhere, you'll find a tremendous number of fantastic, dedicated people who are there doing a tremendous, fantastic job. And they're not doing it just for the money. They're doing it because they're part of a society that has high standards, you know, what's right and what's wrong. Anyway, that's my little rant over. So you mentioned the health service.
Well, coincidentally, we were talking about, I did mention it's bad for disabled people, and one of the groups fighting this is SCOPE, which was set up in 1952, founded by three patients, originally the Spastic Society, since become SCOPE. It's the sort of general disability charity. And actually, one of them was really to tackle disability in a general formation. And they formed in 1952, and 13 years after that, there was a disablement income group supported to tackle pay inequality, which is actually still probably a problem now. I did actually mention last week that there was, in a year after that, the first real proper disability rally took place in Trafalgar Square in London in 1966. And then in 1970, there was the Chronically Sick and Disabled Persons Bill, which is a wonderful thing because it sort of set the ground for a lot of the disability benefits we have now. The only criticism of it, of course, was that it passed without actually anybody asking disabled people. So they did a good job. Maybe the methods used were a little medieval. 1974, they had the Union of Physically Impaired Against Segregation. This is your bias, tackling segregation in the workplace. And it's first to really articulate the social model of disability. And for those of you who aren't aware of the social model of disability, I'll give a basic overview of what that is. It's basically a view that disabled people aren't disabled by any particular medical condition, but rather they're disabled because they live in a society that is not willing to support them fully and not willing to give them the same equality as everyone else. So, 1994, the Union of Physically Impaired Against Segregation, they were the first people really to push forward this theory, which many people, including me, hold dear. In 1981 was the International Year of Disabled People. Did you know that? That's absolutely phenomenal. Disabled People's International was formed that year. The first actual real proper international body dealing with disability issues. And they favoured... they formed as a reaction to the refusal of Rehabilitation International to share power with disabled people, which really is... And, you know...
So what was going on there?
Well, what happened is, obviously, the rehab people, doesn't it? It established an umbrella body that supports and encourages development of hundreds of new organisations controlled by disabled people across the UK and actually across the world, but it doesn't actually say that here. So they obviously wanted an international coverage of disabled people, which is really good. And pretty much not too much change after that until 1991. When Regard was found to challenge an existing homophobia in disabled people's movement and the exclusion of disabled people and lesbian, gay, for the sexual, transgender community. Now, this is a point just before that where we had different groups sort of almost fighting each other, and, you know, obviously they came up with the idea that, well, if we are minorities, then perhaps we should be fighting together.
So you're
on
talking
this
about
issue.
Sort of disabled people and maybe lesbian and gay people, almost like sort of fighting for the moral high ground, saying we're more important to be equal than you are, kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that might have been the case before 1991. I think since then we've kind of woken up to the idea that if we want change for minority groups, then it's really something that we're going to have to do together. Actually, one thing I have. One thing I've neglected to mention is that this was followed up with a combined push, and that led to 1992 Disability Awareness and Actions. This is a year after people have gone way up to this. It established support for self-advocacy and empowerment movements in the disabled community, internationally and nationally, to disabled people's human rights. And then that led to, in 1995, finally, the passing of the Disability Discrimination Act, which introduced legislation to outlaw discrimination against disabled people. Although at the time it was limited in its scope and duty to treat people equally, the definition of disability was decided then to be based on the medical model, which isn't actually such a good thing. But
does that actually get enforced, Jason? That's the problem, isn't it? I mean, if there are five people going for a job and the disabled person is turned down, it's very, very difficult for them to make any kind of, to prove in any way that they've been turned down because they were disabled, or that to prove discrimination. That's a difficult one.
Yeah, it's a problem we have even now, and this is a massive problem facing disabled people at the moment, that since there's been so much cutting of benefits and so much cutting of funding to various things, a lot of people weren't employed disabled people. In fact, I found out from a man who is a former governor of the University of the West of England that 9 out of 10 companies in the private sector won't employ someone if they've even got the slightest hint of depression.
It's almost like into the world of survival of the fittest now, isn't it? Because employers can pick and choose, it's like the law of the jungle. Would you agree?
Well, yeah. Actually, the civil rights movements that preceded the Disability Discrimination Act, which I actually forgot to mention earlier, in 1982, there's one called CORAD, Restrictions Against Disabled People, actually made a very good point on this issue, saying that disabled people were being discriminated against in the workplace, but it was so actually difficult to prove that there needed to be some form of a legislation to try and stop it, and that did eventually result in the Disability Discrimination Act, but even that wasn't perfect. And, Disability Discrimination Act pretty much lasted 15 years until 2010, when the new coalition government decided that we have all these different acts representing all these different equality groups. They decided to fold it into one group and invented the Single Equality Act. And although Single Equality Act still protects the rights of people with disabilities, much has yet to happen to make these rights a daily reality for the 12 million disabled children and adults in the UK.
Well, that's a great summary. What about today, though, Jason? Because we're in a situation where a lot of people are having to go through these ATOS tests. Many people are disabled in many ways, are having to go to this private French business who are basically saying to many, many of them, just almost by default, you're not disabled, or, that then you have to then appeal against that decision. So you're in a situation where, that's actually very, very difficult for many people. Now, I know there's some guy in Cardiff up until recently, anyway, was on hunger strike saying, I'm refusing to do this. This is one of the biggest challenges disabled people have faced for years, surely.
This is absolutely one of the absolute most massive challenges we've faced for years. I mean, I didn't know that particular story, but I certainly know of a few who have committed suicide when they've been declared non-disabled. And it can just be the side thing, I mean, there was a case I mentioned a few weeks ago of a man who was in a coma but was declared fit to work, which is absolutely ridiculous. And actually, I mentioned earlier about the disability definition being given by the American model. Now, in April, there is going to be a new diagnostic manual coming out for US and all the other countries that follow the US model, like the UK. And actually, in that model, they have effectively got rid of Asperger's syndrome. They've decided to refold that as kind of like high-functioning autism. And I don't know if it's going to be similar to dyspraxia, because in some cases, dyspraxia is considered not a strong enough disability to require benefits. So it's one of those things. I think I think a campaign on Facebook put it well. These people are being literally ATOS'd aside, which I thought was...
But I mean, what groups are around for people who are nervous, worried, maybe for themselves or for their neighbours, for their friends, that are worried about being victimised at the moment? Are there any good sort of campaign groups that can maybe offer a bit of support?
Well, there certainly is. I mean, there are a lot of sort of newly disabled advocacy groups. I personally, and you know, the ones, there was a Disabled Rights Commission, which was established in the year 2000 for people who are autistic. There's also the Autistic Rights Movement, if you want to take a look at that. There's Disabled Rights Movement, well, DRM. So there's also, here we are, also the Disability Benefits Consortium and the UK Disabled People's Council. And these groups are excellent self-advocacy groups, and the fact they, the Disability Benefits Consortium, was behind the Hardest Hits campaign in 2011.
Now, I suppose the most important message to get out there is it's not you, it's them. You know, so don't feel that it's your fault, that you're being forced into a situation which is, you know, too difficult, maybe having your mobility taken away, these kinds of things, if you're disabled out there. It's not your fault, it's them. So get together with other disabled people, make sure you get a bit of advice. Don't be afraid necessarily to knock on the door of a neighbour who's an able-bodied person, in order to get a little bit of help to, you know, basically even a shoulder to cry on, somebody who's there to give you some emotional support through what could be a, you know, really horrific and difficult time. And make sure you appeal. I mean, that's the other thing, Jason, isn't it? It seems to be built into the process.
Yeah, make sure you appeal, because there have been a lot of successful appeals recently. In fact, there's been a huge number of successful appeals.
Okay. Thanks very much, Jason. Now, Jeff Sparks is here with his weekly What's On Guide. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Tony.
All right, what do you got for us this week?
Right, starting with Friday 23rd of November, the Free and Bad Company tribute, All Right Now, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews at Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 23rd of November, Point to the Sun will be performing with support from Evil Twin and Oliver Kay at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £3 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Led Zeppelin. In 2007, this group reformed with John Bonham's son, Jason, on drums. It was a one-off benefit concert in memory of music executive Ahmet Ertegun. The concert was released on 19th of November on CD and DVD and was titled Celebration Day. And here is a song from that album titled Good Times, Bad Times. That was Good Times, Bad Times by Led Zeppelin from the album Celebration Day. For more information, you can check out at www.ledzeppelin.com. Into Saturday 24th of November, Doreen will be performing at the Fiddlers in Railway Street, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. Finally, on Sunday 25th of November, Country Rockers at Lost 11 will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and doors open at 4 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks very much, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 p.m. every Friday afternoon. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And as promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch helpline, 01454 318 753. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week.
Makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Broken glass everywhere. People pissing on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise. Got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back. Junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all the cars go by, roaring as the breezes blow. A crazy lady living in a bag, eating out of garbage pails, used to be a fag hag. Such a dance to tango, skipped the life and tango. A silk on print to seem to lost her senses. Down at the peep show, watching all the creeps, so she could tell her stories to the girls back home. She went to the city and got so sedated, she had to get a pimp, she couldn't make it on her own. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. My brother's doing fast on my mother's TV. Says she watches too much, it's just not healthy. All my children in the daytime, Dallas at night. Can't even see the game or the Sugar Ray fight. The bill collectors, they ring my phone and scare my wife when I'm not home. Got a bum education, double-digit inflation. Can't take the train to the job, there's a strike at the station. Me on King Kong, standing on my back, can't stop to turn around. Broke my sacroiliac, a mid-range migraine, cancer membrane. Sometimes I think I'm going insane, I swear I might hijack a plane. Don't push me, call, I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
My son said, Daddy, I don't want to go to school because the teacher's a jerk. He must think I'm a fool and all the kids smoke reefer. I think it'd be cheaper if I just got a job, learn to be a street sweeper. I dance to the beat, shuffle my feet, wear a shirt and tie and run with the creeps because it's all about money. Ain't a damn thing funny. You got to have a con in this land of milk and honey. They pushed that girl in front of the train, took her to the doctor, sewed her arm on the gang. Stabbed that man right in his heart. Gave him a transplant for a brand new start. I can't walk through the park cause it's crazy after dark. Keep my hand on my gun cause they got me on the run. I feel like an outlaw, broke my last glass jaw. Hear them say, you want some more? Living on a seesaw. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. Say what? It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. A child is born with no state of mind, blind to the ways of mankind. God is smiling on you, but he's frowning too, because only God knows what you'll go through. You'll grow in the ghetto, living second rate, and your eyes will sing a song, cause deep hate. The places you play and where you stay looks like one great big alleyway. You'll admire all the number book takers, thugs, pimps, and pushers, and the big money makers. Driving big cars, spending 20s and 10s, and you wanna grow up to be just like them. Smugglers, scramblers, burglars, gamblers, pickpocket peddlers, even panhandlers. You say I'm cool, I'm no fool, but then you wind up dropping out of high school. Now you're unemployed, all non-void, walking around like your pretty boy Floyd. Turned stick-up kid, but look what you done did. Got sent up for an 8-year bid. Now your manhood is took and you're a Maytag. Spend the next 2 years as an undercover fag, being used and abused to serve like hell, till one day you was found hung dead in a cell. It was plain to see that your life was lost. You was cold and your body swung back and forth. But now your eyes sing the sad, sad song of how you live so fast and die so young. So don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Yo, Mel, you see that girl, man?
Yeah, man.
Yo, that sound like cowboy, man.
Cool.
Yo, what's up, money?
Yo.
Hey, where's Creel and Raheem, man?
They upstairs cooling out.
So what's up for tonight, y'all?
Yo, we can go down to the field, man.
Let's go check out Junebug. Hey, yo,